This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Every year, about 30,000 cases of Lyme disease are reported in the United States, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But recent estimates say around 500,000 people are diagnosed and treated for Lyme annually. And that number is only going up. So today on Vermont Edition, we're looking at the growth of Lyme and other tick-borne diseases here in Vermont. Then we'll discuss prevention techniques and hear the stories of people who have been affected by Lyme and are struggling to return to good health. Finally, we'll hear about some vaccines that are on the horizon with an assist from our friends at VPR's people-powered podcast, Brave Little State. They recently did a whole episode about Lyme vaccines that are in the pipeline, and we're really excited to share part of that show with you today. Now, before we get started, some have questioned diagnoses of what's been called chronic or long-haul Lyme, and I want to let our listeners know that we're not going to get into a debate today about that. We're going to stick to the science and talk about what we know. I also want to note that nothing you hear on this show today is a substitute for actual medical advice from your healthcare provider. That said, we will try to answer your questions about Lyme and other tick-borne diseases as best we're able. We are joined first today by Dr. Natalie Quitt. She's the state public health veterinarian. Dr. Quitt, thank you so much for joining us. Hi, Natalie. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Sorry.
Not a problem. This is life during the pandemic. We connect however we're able. Well, thanks so much for joining Vermont Edition. Let's start with the basics. Can you tell us what Lyme disease is?
Sure. Lyme disease is a tick-borne bacterial infection. It's got, there's several strains of bacteria that can cause Lyme disease, but the one that's most common in the U.S. and here in Vermont is called Borrelia burgdorferi. It's transmitted here in Vermont by the black-legged tick, which is called Ixodes scapularis.
And you said transmitted by, so you emphasized that. So not every tick bite is going to give you Lyme, but ticks can be infected, as you said, with and I'm going to mess up the pronunciation, so I'll let you take it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you need a couple things to happen, right? So you need a human to encounter a tick. It has to be the right type of tick, and that tick has to be infected. And not every bite from an infected tick might transmit virus to that human. It has to be a certain length of time that tick is biting that human and feeding from that human for the bacteria, Borrelia burgdorferi, to be transmitted from that tick into the bloodstream of the human that it's feeding on.
Okay. And if somebody does get Lyme disease, what are the effects?
Sure. The symptoms range. Most people who get infected with Borrelia burgdorferi and then, come down with symptoms experience fever, chills, headache, malaise or fatigue, maybe some muscle pain. You could also, for infections that might not be diagnosed and treated quickly, and I did forget to say there could be a rash, which we called erythema migrans. It's the classic bullseye rash, but that doesn't always look like a bullseye. You could also have joint pain. But for some infections, and really rarely, less than 5% of those people with a Lyme disease can come down with what we call disseminated Lyme or manifestations, which can affect the neurologic system, the cardiovascular system. You can get Lyme arthritis, which causes swelling of the joints, or facial palsy, where you get neurologic causes your face to kind of go numb. And then there's some, other neurologic manifestations like radiculopathy.
And we keep hearing that Lyme is growing in prevalence. Is that true? And if so, why?
Yeah, absolutely. So here at the health department, we do surveillance for tick-borne diseases, reportable tick-borne diseases in humans. We do supplement that with some tick-based surveillance, pathogen surveillance in the field. But how it works here at the health department and other health departments across the United States is that we largely do passive surveillance. And so we get laboratory reports, positive laboratory reports for any of our reportable diseases. So for tick-borne, that includes Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, babesiosis, Borrelia miyamotoi disease and Powassan virus. And so we're basically waiting, any of those lab reports that are positive get automatically sent to us from laboratories throughout the state or in any person who's a resident of Vermont. And then we investigate those positive lab reports to see if they those individuals who test positive have the clinical compatibility that then meets the national standardized case definitions for those conditions. And so, yes, we do. We've been doing surveillance for Lyme disease since we've seen it here in the state, and it has been growing over time. Mm-hmm. So, in the early 2000s, it's been on the order of in the tens, and now it's not uncommon to see our case counts, both confirmed and probable human Lyme disease each year, range between anywhere from 500 to over 1,000 each year. And so it fluctuates year to year, but on the over time, it's on the general upward trend.
Now, going from the tens to the hundreds seems like an enormous increase for around two decades. Is that because, in part, awareness around Lyme and tick-borne diseases has increased, or is it that the prevalence of this disease really is going up so quickly?
Yeah, so it's a couple of factors. As you say, it could be that the awareness among the medical community and testing has gone up, and therefore, there's more testing happening, so more diagnoses. There are ecological factors we think are at play. So if you look at a map of the United States and see the areas where Lyme disease has the highest incidence in the United States, which is our mid-Atlantic, northeastern, and upper Midwestern states. Many studies have looked at those geographic ranges of Lyme disease and has shown that it's been expanding in all possible directions. So from our view in Vermont, we're at the northern leading edge of the risk area in the northeastern United States. And so over time, we've seen that risk in Vermont kind of move northward from the southern, the high counties in the southern part of the state to the northern part of the state. And because we think that's, likely because there's more, there could be climate change factors at play there, and there might be more ticks that we're seeing move, northward across the state. But for the southern edge of those risk areas, those ticks are already there. And so it could be more having to do with the pathogen and it being infecting those ticks more.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like even just this year, we've seen, a lot of media coverage about the increase in tick numbers. I remember a particularly striking article in 7 Days about ticks that latch onto moose and become so numerous that they end up killing the animal. So it does seem like it's many different versions of these tick-based problems are increasing.
Certainly. So not just Ixodes scapularis, the one that transmits, that transmits all of our, tick-borne diseases of concern in Vermont. Other ticks might be affected as well.
Let's go now to Barbara in Westford. Barbara, you are on the line. Go ahead, please.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
My question is, in the last 5 years, has the state of Vermont collected deer ticks in various areas of the state and tested them for Lyme, Babesia, and anaplasmosis so that the percentage of ticks infected with these pathogens is known? And if not, why not? Especially since to transmit anaplasmosis, the tick does not have to be attached very long.
Thank you, Barbara. Natalie, how is the state collecting and testing ticks?
Yeah, thank you for your question. The Vermont Department of Health has a partnership with the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, the vector surveillance group over there, by which we collaborate on a tick pathogen surveillance program. It only really became started in 2018, but I know Agency of Agriculture has been collecting and testing ticks for many years prior to that. But through this collaborative effort, We've chosen 48 collection sites throughout Vermont, and keeping those pretty standard so we can kind of watch how the ticks, and their pathogen prevalence over time. And so, yes, to your question, every year, Agency of Agriculture vector surveillance colleagues go out in the field every spring and fall, collect ticks through several visits at all of those sites, and they organize them by species, and they send the relevant species, which is the Ixodes scapularis tick, and is the tick we collect most often, most abundant, and send it to CDC for testing for Borrelia burgdorferi, the causative agent for Lyme disease, Anaplasma phagocytophilum, which is the causative agent for anaplasmosis. And yes, they test for Babesia microti and Borrelia miyamotoi. And so to add to that, what we are seeing is that it's the tick testing pathogen prevalence is really matching up with what we see in humans around the state. So we are seeing higher infection rates in the southern part of the state, all the way up to Rutland County, but we've seen still infected ticks pretty far north as well. And ticks are most commonly infected with Borrelia burgdorferi, then Anaplasma phagocytophilum, then Babesia microti, then Borrelia miyamotoi. And that is the order of commonality that we see of those diseases in humans.
Now, Natalie, who is most at risk for contracting Lyme disease?
Sure. For, every tick-borne disease is a little different, but for Lyme disease, it's pretty clear the epidemiology that we know about it from years and years of surveillance throughout the United States is pretty clear that the, every age group can be affected, both males and females, but there's a very clear bimodal age distribution where we see those age groups higher risk for Lyme disease. And what I mean by that is that children ages about 5 to 15 and adults ranging anywhere from 55 to 80 are at highest risk for Lyme disease. Those are the most common individuals that we see Lyme disease in. And for most age groups, males are more affected than females.
Do you know why that is?
There could be biological factors, but also behavioral factors and the way we interact with the environment and our risk prevention behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Now, later in the program, we are going to be talking more about prevention, but I would love to get your take on this as somebody who is around ticks. It sounds like a whole lot. What are the ways that you suggest people prevent being infected by one of these tick-borne illnesses?
Yeah, and I think as a Vermonter, we can all say we're all around ticks more than we would like, especially in the spring and the spring through the fall. Even now, we're seeing lots of ticks. But what the health department does mostly is educate, and we want people to know that it's not hopeless. There are clear ways that have been well studied that can help prevent tick-borne illness, and this is not just for Lyme disease. Avoiding tick bites and removing ticks quickly can prevent all the types of tick-borne diseases we see here. So we usually say protect, check, remove, and watch. So protect yourself, first of all, by staying out of tick habitat as much as you can. We know that's not always possible because we want everyone to enjoy the outdoors, but you could try to stick to the center of trails and stay out of wooded, brushy areas. Wear long sleeves and long pants, bright colors so you can see if ticks are crawling on your clothing. Use EPA registered tick repellents, such as DEET. You can also treat your, a couple pairs of your outdoor clothing with something called permethrin, which lasts through several washes. You also want to protect your pets. Talk to your veterinarian about vet approved tick prevention products. There are studies out there that show that people with pets are actually at higher risk for tick encounters than people without pets, particularly if those pets go outdoors. If you do go out into tick habitat, always, always check your body and your clothing after you come in from the outdoors and your pet. Another proven method of prevention is showering. soon after coming indoors. So within 2 hours of after being outdoors. So this gives you an opportunity to do a tick check, but also washes off any unattached ticks that might still be on your body. You want to remove any attached ticks. So if you do find any, you want to remove those promptly. And then if you do get any tick bites, you want to watch yourself for symptoms for at least 30 days after that.
All right. Those are some great tips. We are joined now by Dr. Trey Dobson. He's the chief medical officer at Southwestern Vermont Medical Center and an emergency medicine physician, with Dartmouth Hitchcock Health. He has a special clinical interest in Lyme disease, and he hosts a weekly talk show on medical issues. Dr. Dobson, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
We are also joined by Alexis Chesney, a naturopathic physician who specializes in Lyme. Welcome, Alexis.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, first, Dr. Dobson, I hear you have lots of firsthand experience with ticks from being out on the trails with your dogs. Is that right?
Oh, that's right. And many people in Vermont are getting out with their pets. So as Natalie said, those with pets have higher incidence of getting Lyme disease, or at least getting ticks, but there are ways to do it that are safe, and you can still go out and enjoy the outdoors with your four-legged friends.
So is that something that you've had to keep a close eye on your dogs? Do you check them regularly?
Absolutely, I do. And, you know, even though this is very difficult to show, there is an altitudinal relationship, or at least an environmental relationship. So I do my best to get as high as possible, you know, with them when we're out trail running. And definitely it decreases the chance that they come back with, you know, loads of ticks all over their body. But sometimes it happens, and we just take it as part of the risk of getting outdoors, and well worth it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Alexis, you wrote a book about preventing Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. And part of the book focuses on controlling ticks by focusing on the animals that host them. So I'd love for you to share some of the ways of doing that in the home setting that some of our listeners might be able to do from where they live.
Sure, absolutely. I am quite passionate about tick bite prevention. So one thing that you can do, as Natalie mentioned, permethrin can be used on clothing to prevent tick bites for humans. It can also be applied in other ways. You can actually make tick tubes. And this is something I've reviewed with patients, and I've seen differences when they've come back and reported how the tick population in their yards have decreased from 1 year to the next by using them. And there's also research behind this. So let me explain what this is. You can do it at home yourself, or you can buy them. So tick tubes really look at the mouse population, because most black-legged ticks are getting infected by attaching to a white-legged mouse. And so those are ways to try and intercept this issue with the ticks then infecting the mice, which then later, the mice infecting the ticks, which later can attach to humans and then transmit Borrelia burgdorferi and other tick-borne pathogens to us. So what you do is you take either some kind of toilet paper tube or a paper towel tube. You can save those, and you can go outside with your permethrin. Also bring some cotton balls or some kind of lint material from the dryer, and then spray that material down with permethrin. Be careful, because permethrin is toxic to our skin, so you want to use gloves and keep animals away. When it's dried, it is safe for us. So you spray down that material, and then you put it into the tubes, and then you put that out in your yard. And what will happen is the mice will bring that material back to their nests. And in the nests, if they and their family members have ticks attached to them, they will die upon contact with that permethrin. And that has decreased the exposure to ticks on humans by 93.6%. There was a study done on this, and that's just amazing to think about. And also, I see when I hear reports back from my patients that this really makes a difference in what they're seeing on their cats and dogs bringing in ticks, and their children and themselves, that it's close to zero. So that's been exciting.
Well, speaking of animals, I think we have another animal-based question from a listener. Phil in Guilford, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I was wondering, do you know if turkeys eat ticks?
That is a question I don't know the answer to. We'll give that to our state veterinarian, Natalie Quitt. Do turkeys eat ticks?
That's a good question, too. I don't really know the answer as well, but I think many foraging outdoor poultry can find ticks and eat them. It's a question of whether those ticks are going to be in their environment. So it depends on, I guess, where they're foraging, because we do see ticks more in the sort of edges of properties where the grass kind of gets long, longer, into the trees, and there's got to be, maybe some leaf litter there. So I guess it depends on where they're foraging and if they're actually encountering those ticks.
Mm-hmm. And now briefly, you mentioned landscaping, and Alexis, I know that you talk about that in your book as well. Are there one or two quick landscaping tips that you can give listeners to kind of help prevent the spread of these ticks near the home?
Sure. So thinking about if you have a yard, creating a 3-foot margin as a tick barrier from a wooded area. So ticks don't like to be dried out because that kills them. They love moisture. They thrive in moisture. So if you think about places that are shaded, that are moist, of course, we live in a very moist area a lot of the year. But if you think of your landscape of your yard, you can create barriers or move things away from that transition. If you do have grass that then moves into a wooded area. So bringing things like a playset or a garden away from that edge. You can also use things like wood chips to create more of a barrier. Cedar has been shown to be effective as a repellent, so you could use cedar wood chips. That can be helpful. And just thinking about where mice like to live as well, that's often where ticks might like to live, in those places. So like stone walls, being careful of that, the wood pile. Those are some tips for you.
Mm-hmm. Now, try as we might, we can't always prevent tick bites. Dr. Dobson, how do you diagnose Lyme if somebody comes to you saying they think that they might have that, or they come to you with, a set of different issues that they don't know the cause for?
Right. So as Natalie said, and you've been alluding to, the medical community of all types of individuals in medicine are much more aware of the symptoms of Lyme and other tick-borne illness these days than perhaps 25 years ago. So that's a big plus right there. In other words, it's at the top of our thinking when someone presents with a fever or muscle aches. Unfortunately, now for 18 months, we've been dealing with another disease that causes fever and muscle aches. So that's just thrown into your differential diagnosis. You try not to look at symptoms that aren't reported much and quickly do a bunch of testing for Lyme. You have to be careful and test when appropriate and understand the disease process. So in general, mostly we break up Lyme into three different areas, which I believe Natalie was kind of alluding to. There's the early localized disease where people present with muscle aches, fatigue, lethargy, typically a headache. And then early disseminated disease, where it can start affecting their heart or their brain. You start getting skin lesions. And then late disease, which can happen after several months after the tick has attached to someone and transmitted the spirochete. And these go really into neurologic disease that is sort of profound and harder to recover from, and musculoskeletal symptoms. And that sort of bridges into what you were alluding to earlier about longer term effects of Lyme disease. So we just have it in our differential real early, especially in the more common things like muscle aches, joint aches, skin lesions, and fever, and then do appropriate testing or other diagnostics to determine whether or not Lyme or the other tick-borne illnesses are at play.
Let's go down to John in Burlington. John, you are on the air. What's your comment or question?
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
So I grew up spending my summers in Old Lyme, Connecticut. And I actually had Lyme disease twice. Both times I had the bullseye. So by the second time I knew I had it. My sister, unfortunately, did not have a bullseye, or she may have had it in an area where it wasn't seen. So we didn't know that she had Lyme disease until she woke up one day and had Bell's palsy in her face. So I just was wondering, my question is, a disease with such that could be so bad, with such, you know, dire consequences, why aren't healthcare providers taking more of a proactive approach, especially with children?
Dr. Dobson, I'd love for you to weigh in on this. What ways are healthcare providers taking a proactive approach and trying to help children with this illness?
Sure. Well, so he's exactly right that initially it was difficult to ascertain what was being caused by Lyme disease and other things. I will tell you, this is sort of keeps coming up every year, and I can reassure you that healthcare providers are taking a lot of initiatives. I'm on a radio show right this minute, and that's one of the initiatives, along with Alexis and Natalie. So we are getting out there in the public. Again, it's at the top of our differential these days when someone presents with these types of symptoms. Also, we're talking about prevention. We're talking about later some of the newer technologies and treatments for the disease. So yes, it is true that in the past, just like a lot of diseases, when they first come about, they're harder to figure out. But right now, I can say with good confidence that most physicians, most primary care providers, and others out there that are in healthcare consider Lyme disease, consider the other tick-borne illnesses highly when they think about when a patient presents and what could be going on. Now, unfortunately, as an emergency physician, I will tell you, some people present just like your sister, only with Bell's palsy. In fact, they don't even have the fever or the bullseye rash or some of the other things, or at least they don't remember those things. So it is hard. Fortunately, the earlier the treatment, the better the results. And even with Bell's palsy and other neurologic conditions, generally the treatment, not always, but generally the treatment does provide fairly quick, lasting relief.
Now, Dr. Dobson, I spoke to a listener recently. Her name is Melita Bass, and she heard Brave Little States episode on Lyme vaccine research, and she called in to talk to me about her own experience with Lyme and about how she's been dealing with issues that she believes stem from Lyme for many years at this point. She was first diagnosed in 2016. And I'm wondering if you could just briefly address how, like those symptoms that some folks say do last for years after treatment.
Sure. Well, undoubtedly, there are individuals that experience long-lasting symptoms from Lyme disease, just like there are individuals that experience long-lasting symptoms from many disease processes. Sometimes it's hard to figure out what's going on, and then it's even harder to figure out what the treatment might be, because what typically has occurred, not always, but typically the causative agent is gone from the system, and now it's your own body's immune response that is causing some of these problems. And so therefore, making sure that that is really what's going on and not something new that deserves treatment is a challenge. And then the second is figuring out, okay, what can we do about it? We don't want to play into people's anxieties and fears. We want to do the right thing. We want to consider long-term effects in our differential diagnosis and figure out the best way to treat them in ways that don't harm them. So sometimes treatment gets started without really understanding if a treatment is appropriate. And that's what we want to be careful on. But definitely the caller that spoke with you, I am certain she was experiencing symptoms and they may or may not be related to Lyme, and we'd have to continue to look at them. There are many other diseases though, just for the audience here, that have similar things, even streptococcal pharyngitis, standard strep throat. We've known for over 100 years that it can lead to long-term effects in a very minority, a very small number of people, and those deserve attention.
Let's go now to Leah in Huntington. Leah, excuse me if I'm mispronouncing your name. You are on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Leah out in Huntington, and the reason why I'm calling is because my dog was actually diagnosed with Rocky Mountain spotted fever this past spring, and I'm wondering if this disease, this tick-borne disease, is on the radar of either the state veterinarians and or our healthcare professionals here in Vermont. Thanks.
State public health veterinarian Natalie Quitt, can you address Leah's question?
Sure. So Rocky Mountain spotted fever, we also do surveillance for here in Vermont in humans. It's one that we still don't consider as a locally transmitted infection, particularly because most of the cases we investigate have a history of travel, or the lab tests that we get in those individuals are only meet sort of probable. So they're not confirmatory test results. So we still don't believe that that's been circulating here in Vermont. And so, we always look to travel. So that could be something going on with your pet if you've been to an area where, Rocky Mountain spotted fever or Rickettsia rickettsii is the bacterial agent that causes it. Where they were encountered that. It's transmitted by several different ticks, American dog tick, which is here in Vermont, but the ones we've tested have not had the pathogen, Rocky Mountain wood tick, which is not here in Vermont, that's more in Western states, and then the brown dog tick. But so Rocky Mountain spotted fever, we see more commonly out west in southwestern states. We have seen it as close as I think Massachusetts here. And also testing is imperfect too. So I think the test you're talking about most tests we see for dogs and humans can be serologic based. And so when you get a positive serologic test, you're detecting antibodies that your body has produced from an infection, and that infection might be gone. So it might be a previous exposure to that pathogen. And so that's why you could see it positive. So it always has to be paired with looking at clinical signs and symptoms to see if it's compatible with that illness.
Now, we're going to have to take a break in a moment. And when we come back, we're going to talk about vaccines for Lyme disease that are in the pipeline. Now, Alexis Chesney, before we go to break and have to let you go, I would love if you could share your feelings on these vaccines that are coming down the road.
I think it's interesting. I would love to see how the phase 3 trial goes. I know that's what the Valneva Pfizer vaccine is going into, at least that one that's OspA based. So I think there's a lot to learn. The Lymerix, which was a similar vaccine, similar technology, not exactly the same, was about 50% effective in literature. So I hope that it might be more effective. One thing I'd like to say is that if there is a vaccine for Lyme disease, we still need to be mindful that there are these other tick-borne diseases. So there are other pathogens that may not be covered by that vaccine. So I highly recommend continuing with good practices of prevention, using permethrin, for instance. Just treating your socks and shoes gives a 73 time less likely to get tick bites. So that is another little tip just before we go. Thank you.
Alexis Chesney is a naturopathic physician specializing in the treatment of Lyme and other tick-borne illnesses. We are here with state public health veterinarian Natalie Quitt and Dr. Trey Dobson. Now, let's turn to vaccines, kind of the silver lining to this entire conversation. Dr. Dobson, can you talk us through two of these vaccines that are currently in development, Lyme PrEP and VLA-15? What should we know about them?
Sure. Well, let me just start off by saying, echoing what Alexis said earlier, a lot of these things are targeted towards Lyme disease and maybe not necessarily other types of tick-borne illnesses that Natalie reviewed in the beginning. And so it is very important that we pursue these treatments and preventative measures, as well as do the preventative measures with the permethrin and tick check. So I just want to put that out there, because there is a concern that once a good preventative vaccine or similar agent is available, that folks will forget to do the other things, and we'll continue to see lots of Lyme disease in those situations, or at least other tick-borne illnesses. So in general, you know, the way we're looking at these prophylactic treatments, in other words, treatments before the tick, you encounter the tick, is through not only vaccine, but monoclonal antibody, and then some anti-parasitic agents. And so these three different types. So let me just explain those real quick. I think everyone is quite familiar with vaccines, especially over the past 18 months and all the discussion on vaccines. Vaccines tell your body to make a protein that latches on to the causative agent, in this situation, Lyme disease. And then by latching onto it, it basically secures it, prevents it from causing infection, and your body gets rid of it. So that's a vaccine. Monoclonal antibody is a way to not induce your own immune cells to make proteins against the causative agent, but rather just giving you the proteins against the causative agent. So these are giving you those antibodies yourself, and then you have them circulating in your serum and in your blood. And then when you encounter the agent, in this case, Lyme, again, the spirochete, that they are ready to attach and render that bacteria non-effective. And then finally, this kind of interesting idea of an anti-parasitic agent basically means you would take a pill, and sort of like your animals, your pets, when the tick attaches to you, this anti-parasitic pill would cause you to have the ability to sort of paralyze that tick before it could transmit the disease. The tick would just fall off of you and die. So in summary, there are three things. There's the vaccine. And then there is this Lyme PrEP, which is the name for a monoclonal antibody treatment on the market, or it will be on the market. Sorry, it's in trials. Hopefully will be on the market. And then this anti-parasitic agents.
And thank you for bringing up all three of those. And I want to turn to our friends over at the podcast Brave Little State, because I think they also did a great job of diving into these different vaccines that are in the works. Now, we're going to play a segment from their recent episode that's all about Lyme vaccines. And I also just want to say thank you to our callers who have called in and are waiting patiently on the line. We are going to try to get to as many of your calls as possible. Now, in this clip, you're going to hear the voice of Brave Little State host Angela Evansy, but the first voice you're going to hear is Sue Halpern. She's a professor at Middlebury College and a writer for The New Yorker. And she recently wrote this big piece for The New Yorker about Lyme vaccines. And she talks off with talking about this method that could help prevent Lyme.
They are addressing a question that anyone who has a dog and probably a cat has asked themselves over and over again.
Which is, how come my dog / cat can take a chewable to prevent Lyme disease and I can't? Sue says there's a small California company, Tarsus Pharmaceuticals, that primarily works on eye care. They were trying to develop a drug for these mites that some people get on their eyelids, and they were working with an ingredient found in a veterinary brand called Cardilio.
And they found that this particular drug, they found that it killed the thing that they were trying to kill, which was mites on your eyelid. Of which apparently is a big problem. And in the course of doing that, they realized that it also had the potential to do what it does for your dog or your cat, which is kill the tick.
A circuitous way to begin this kind of research, to be sure, but better late than never. Bobby Azamian is the CEO of Tarsus.
A person would take it, let's say, every month or two over the Lyme season, and they could take it even potentially the day before they were worried about being exposed.
This drug, called TP05, doesn't target the Borrelia inside the tick like the others do. It targets the tick.
It paralyzes the tick before the tick can transmit Borrelia.
They are just starting their first clinical trial. So they are kind of, you know, in the development process probably a couple years behind the others.
And we are preparing to have further dialogue with the FDA about the phase 2 and phase 3 pathway.
But potentially, if they succeed, it becomes a very simple way of protecting yourself against Lyme ticks.
This drug, TP05, would definitely be different from Lyme Prep or the Valneva Pfizer vaccine. Instead of getting jabbed, you'd pop a tablet every month or two. And while it's still too soon to say, it might help prevent tick-borne illnesses beyond Lyme, like anaplasmosis. Because, after all, ticks can carry multiple diseases.
That is one of the potential advantages of a chemical in contrast to a biologic or a vaccine that's really only targeted to the Borrelia bacteria.
Tarsus's marketing director joined this interview. Her name is Maza Martin, and she stressed the flexibility of this kind of Lyme prevention.
You know, this is something that could be used for folks who live in endemic areas, and then as well as people who work outdoors, as well as those traveling, vacationing, going to an area where there may be a lot of ticks.
I do think the convenience of this, you know, not have to go into a doctor's office, but get a prescription for this, pick it up at the pharmacy, potentially.
If you can hear some sales pitch here, well, of course you can. This is a California startup. I think one reason is obviously competition. With Lyme on the rise, this is going to be a growing market.
That was an excerpt from Brave Little State's recent podcast episode all about Lyme vaccines, hosted by Angela Evansy. Now, I want to go to, we only have a couple minutes left. We have a lot of callers. I want to make sure we get to Tom in Newport, who has been waiting patiently on the line. Tom, what is your question? Hi, Tom, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I understand that there's a wide genetic diversity in Borrelia, and some people think there's different species of Borrelia. I just wondered if that is going to be a problem in developing an effective vaccine. Thank you. I'll get off the line now.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Dr. Dobson, can you address Tom's question?
Sure. And also, Natalie has a lot of background on this as well. There are different strains of Borrelia, and then you can even subdivide them even further. But so far, they're very regional, you know, different ones listed in Europe and in other parts of the United States. And although it's something to follow, it's not yet a concern as far as or similar to what you might think of a virus mutating or other types of organisms. It seems pretty specific that this type of spirochete, even the different species of the spirochete or subspecies of the spirochete are going to follow the same pathway for treatment through antimicrobials. And also certainly they follow the same type of preventative measures to prevent the tick from attaching to you in the first place.
Thank you, Dr. Dobson. Let's go now to Ray in Montgomery. Ray, you are on the air. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I just wanted to call in quickly and recommend the University of Rhode Island have a program set up called Tick Spotters, and you can take a picture of a tick that's on your clothing or that, you know, came into your house, and they'll identify it, and even if the tick was attached, they'll tell you whether it's a it's a tick that's carrying any of these horrible Lyme disease or other things. And I've used this resource when we bought a tick in by accident, and it turned out it was a dog tick. The other thing I'd mention, and the University of Rhode Island Tick Spotter site has a link to a company called Insect Shield that will sell you clothing that's saturated with perithrin. So you can actually buy this clothing, order it in any size you need. I bought a pair of the pants, and then any ticks that try to attach to that clothing supposedly will die. So I thought I'd mention that.
Thank you, Ray. Natalie, I'm curious, have you heard of this tool at the University of Rhode Island, or does Vermont have a similar service?
Yes, I have. I would say, you know, we have pictures of ticks online, but it's not as, you know, detailed as the Rhode Island program. But I do want to put a plug in too for our Agency of Agriculture has a passive tick surveillance program where you can send in ticks found on yourself or on your pets, and they will identify it to species. Because as the caller said, it's important to know what species of tick bit you, because only, you know, certain types, Ixodes scapularis, pose the risk for the tick-borne diseases we see here in Vermont, and then you know to watch for symptoms of those diseases after being bit.
We have just a couple minutes left, but now let's go to Dan in Williamstown. Dan, I believe you have a tip for us to help us end our show.
Yeah, sure. We live in a very highly infested tick area, and we don't have to leave the property to get ticks. And we were getting so many this spring that I made a sweep out of a 4x4 piece of cotton sheet and attached it to a wooden bar and rope on either end. And I drug it around the borders and got over 200 ticks.
Oh, wow. What a creative way to trap those ticks. Thank you for calling in, Dan. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have today. Dr. Natalie Quitt is the state public health veterinarian with the Vermont Department of Health, and Dr. Trey Dobson is an emergency medicine physician with Dartmouth Hitchcock Health and the chief medical officer at Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. Thank you both for joining our show.